Hello, and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor at Town Hall, and today I'm joined by...
Hey, I'm Tim Lee. I am a, I guess, senior editor is my title at Vox.com. I write about technology.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on, Tim. We're going to talk about net neutrality, and there's been a lot of developments recently kind of that I think portend what the future of the internet's going to look like. But first, I wanted to ask you about the leaked FCC proposal for that would kind of in spirit allow what are called fast lanes, and ask you how you see this going forward, because the FCC was kind of a little panicked by this leak, and how you see that affecting the way that we perceive net neutrality and what that portends for the future.
Sure. So I think to understand what's going on here, you have to go back to January when the FCC had a previous set of net neutrality rules that the DC Circuit Court here in DC said was not consistent with the laws that Congress had put out. And so the new chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, has been thinking about what to do in reaction to that. And most people expected him to put forward a new set of network neutrality regulations because both he and President Obama have said they're in favor of net neutrality. And so this was his attempt to deal with that court decision and come up with some sort of internet regulations that was consistent with that court decision and also protected net neutrality, supposedly. And so what he did was he came up with a proposal that did as much as he thought he could get away with given the limits that the court had put in place. And specifically, the rule, according to reports, and this could change once we see the final rule, but the reports say that it allows ISPs to give to prioritize different times of traffic if doing so is commercially reasonable, and that is a legal term that comes from some previous court decisions, and nobody's quite sure what that means specifically, but it's generally assumed to mean a less strict rule protecting net neutrality. Than the one that the FCC tried to put forward in 2010, and the court said were exceeded the FCC's authority.
Right now, the so-called fast lane proposal that applies to what's called, I want to clarify here. Does that apply to what's called the last mile of the internet, which is between Comcast and the consumer, rather than between Comcast and other packet servicing organizations?
Yes, that's right. So generally, when we're talking about net neutrality, we're focusing on what's called the last mile, which is cable companies like Comcast and Time Warner, or telephone companies like AT&T and Verizon. Is regulations limiting them from giving priority to some content over others on their own network? So there's other parts of the internet. There's data centers that host, websites. There's long distance network providers that provide us, what's called transit to get traffic from one end of the internet to the other. Generally speaking, net neutrality doesn't affect those companies. It only affects the companies that are on the consumer facing side, where consumers are signing up for internet access.
Right. So, what would the advocates of net neutrality? What would they say the downsides to this kind of proposal are? Because from my perspective, I would say kind of in my vision of a worst case scenario, right, is that Comcast signs a deal with Hulu to provide really fast HD quality video content over the last mile to the consumers. And because of that, let's say Netflix's service is suboptimal compared to that. So we could say, in a future where Comcast and Time Warner have merged and they're servicing by far the largest consumer base of any ISP, that puts Netflix at a huge disadvantage compared to a competitor like Hulu, right?
Right. That's right. So I think there's two classes of potential problems. One is the one you just alluded to, which is that Netflix is a potential disruptive innovation for traditional paid television services. So Comcast has, you can subscribe for cable service from Comcast. It might cost you $100 a month or more for that service. And if a company like Netflix comes along and offers much more affordable service, a lot of people might want to cancel their service. And so the fear is that Comcast might use its control over that last mile to either degrade the quality of services like Netflix that they think are a competitive threat, or else charge Netflix so much money that they're not able to offer a product that's a viable alternative to those cable companies. At the other end of the spectrum, the other type of concern, I think, is that when you have one of the advantages of the current internet architecture is that if you buy a web server somewhere, you basically automatically get reasonably good service everywhere in the world. Like your website, anybody can go download it. It's reasonably fast. And I think there's a concern that if ISPs start carving up their networks into fast lanes and slow lanes, that might be fine for a big company that's dealing with all these individual ISPs anyway. But if you're a small company just getting into the market, it might just be too burdensome to have to go around to Comcast and AT&T and Verizon and Cablevision and Time Warner Cable and, you know, not to mention in other countries, and sign all these special Fastlane deals. And so by default, companies that don't have the money and the logistical resources will end up in the slow lane and be at a disadvantage.
Right. What's the, I guess, kind of the pace of technological advancement seems so fast, though, that let's say you become a competitor to Netflix, or I'm not entirely sure what other kind of entertainment platform might exist, but it seems like you might not, I mean, the bandwidth might be there anyway to become a competitor, right? And maybe you're not delivering super HD quality, but you're delivering maybe 480 or 720 to people's homes. Is that really going to be that large of kind of a hurdle to clear? I mean, I guess it would depend on the difference, the speed difference between that fast lane and slow lane, right? But is that really going to be a sufficiently large hurdle to clear for, let's say, new entrants into the market?
Yeah, so I think it's a little bit hard to say, right? So the fastest, highest bandwidth application right now is high-definition video, and that may be the fastest thing for the foreseeable future. But it's hard to predict what other kinds of applications might come along, and it's hard to predict what people's quality expectations. So the TV manufacturers are working on a 4K specification that requires significantly more bandwidth than even HD video today. Right now, that's kind of a seems like something that maybe consumers aren't going to care that much about, but maybe 10 years from now, it'll be seen as standard that everybody's got to have a 4K television set. It also depends on how the market evolves. If we hope that ISPs will continue providing more and more bandwidth, but if there's not much competition and they see this as a competitive threat, maybe they'll slow down the pace of innovation. I mean, to be clear, this isn't something that that I personally think that is a big threat. I mean, I think in the long run, everybody's going to be fine. Like, networks are going to keep getting faster and cheaper and all that. But, the difference between it getting faster at kind of a medium pace for getting faster rapidly is, I think, a big deal. And I'd rather live in a world where you have an open internet where everybody has access to the same service. Because if nothing else, you could imagine an alternative universe where YouTube didn't come along until 2010 or 2012 or something. And that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, but it's good that it came along in 2005.
Right. Now, what I've seen, at least a lot of conservatives say, is that a large part of these problems and these fears, which, we are talking purely hypotheticals here, because for the most part, the principles of net neutrality are in effect right now without, legal regulations. But, and what conservatives I've seen have said is that one of the biggest problems and one of the things that kind of plays into that fear is the monopoly power of a lot of last mile providers. That, for example, I'm in Washington, D.C., and there are a couple different internet providers and cable television providers in Washington, D.C., but only one services where I live right now. I have Comcast or nothing. But we've seen kind of, and there's a lot of backstory to that of telecommunications policy history of why that is. But we're seeing more of a proliferation of competition. And it's not that it's going to become, a very, very broad market for where you can get your cable and internet services. But, Verizon is building out Fios here. RCN has long been a pseudo secondary competitor in the cable market. And conservatives would say that what we need to do is kind of deregulate a lot of these local franchising laws to get some of the competitors. Because at that point, then, if Comcast has, a high speed lane for one certain kind of video service and the other organizations don't, they can obviously use that in the competition wars, and no, there won't be the incentive to discriminate based on services that way. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that is like a reasonable alternative to, you know, legal regulations that would enforce packet neutrality rules?
So one of the weird things about broadband networks is if you think about the net market for like shoes, everybody pretty much has the option of buying from all the shoe manufacturers, right? Because shoes can be shipped across state lines and there's stores that stock lots of options. Broadband is very localized. So, you know, there are dozens of broadband providers, but as you were saying, in any given location, there's usually only one or two options. It's usually your cable company and maybe your local phone company has a DSL or a fiber option. So it's certainly true that there are some examples of companies upgrading their networks. So Fios, it's great that Fios is building a fiber optic network, but that's Verizon, who was already a DSL provider. RCN has done a little bit of building out, but it's in a very small number of cities. And I think the same is true of Google Fiber, which is a great thing. I'd love to see every city in the country have Google Fiber, but so far I think it's Kansas City and maybe Austin. In a year it might be 5 or 10 kind of medium-sized metro areas. But for 90% of us, it's still basically going to be Comcast and maybe a telephone company. So I think that if your argument is based on the idea that the broadband market is going to get a lot more competitive, I think that's probably overly optimistic. And I've been writing and thinking about these issues for about 10 years, and the debate largely was the same 10 years ago. There's about to be all this competition. And actually, I think, the entrance of Fios was a big deal. And one of the reasons I was more optimistic about this 10 years ago, because you started to see Fios rolling out fiber. And the assumption was that AT&T and CenturyLink, the other phone companies, would do similarly. What you've actually seen recently is that I think the Fios financials haven't turned out as well as they'd hoped. I mean, they haven't completely stopped rolling out Fios, but the speed at which they're doing it has slowed, and you have not seen anybody else say, oh, that's a great opportunity, other than Google. Google's basically the only other example you see of somebody who's doing a really ambitious rollout of broadband in more than a trivial number of households.
So you don't see, I mean, I would agree with that, is that these are issues that have been being talked about for a long time now, and we really haven't seen all that much advancement. I mean, Fios entered the Washington, D.C. market, 3 years ago maybe. And I'm in a fairly, populated area, and we're not even close to receiving it. But I have seen, in other places, my parents are in Houston. They have AT&T U-verse, which I'm not very familiar with that service, but it does seem a competitor to, I believe, Time Warner is the dominant market holder there. And to a certain extent,
to be clear, like it's not the case that the market's terrible, right? I mean, there are countries where you have one telecommunication monopoly, and here we at least have cable and telephone in most cases, so that's good. We are seeing people upgrading to fiber, so the situation isn't terrible. The question is just what's the counterfactual? I mean, if you look at something like computer chips, like they get their speed like doubles every 18 months. It's quite possible that, the Google Fiber has gigabit connections. You can imagine an alternative world where if you somehow did have a lot of competition, maybe gigabit internet would be the standard everywhere. It's not that the situation is terrible. It's just that you could imagine that it would be a lot faster if you had policies that were better at promoting innovation.
Right. I want to move on to I don't know if you would call it a deal, the agreement that Comcast signed with Netflix's packet provider, right? Because we saw Netflix, I've seen traffic charts, I think you had one on Vox, about kind of the degradation of packet quality on Comcast networks when it came to Netflix, because Netflix was trying to get, is it Level 3 or Cogent that's Netflix's packet? packet provider, I don't remember, but trying to extract money from them in an agreement that used to be what's called peering, which is a fee-free exchange of traffic, right? And they were able to extract money for carrying Netflix's traffic.
Right.
And that seems, at least to me and maybe to you, a little more scary for the future of networks because of a whole host of different reasons. I think you've written about how the consolidation of Comcast and Time Warner would be a huge development in that area. How do you see kind of, I don't want to call them rents, but rents being extracted from packet providers to last mile providers evolving the internet in the next, you know, 10 years?
So this is a little bit of a tricky thing to explain, and I had some diagrams of a piece that I did last Friday that maybe you can link to that'll help make it a little bit more understandable. Basically, the way the internet has traditionally been, the way it's traditionally worked is that a last mile ISP like Comcast would pay a company like Level 3 for the service called Transit, which is basically carrying traffic over long distances. And one of the advantages of this is that given that the transit companies are the ones that are receiving the payments, that transit market is very competitive. And so the rates that those companies pay is set by a competitive process. And so you don't have to worry too much about anti-competitive types of problems. And what's happened recently is that the largest broadband providers, especially Comcast and Verizon, seem to believe that they have enough leverage in these negotiations that they can actually start demanding that the money flow in the other direction. That rather than Comcast or Verizon paying a company like Level 3 to deliver traffic to it, they say, hey, you're actually, quote unquote, dumping this traffic on our network, and so you should pay us for the privilege of delivering it to our customers. And so there was this big standoff over this where Netflix and the companies that Netflix paid to deliver the traffic to these companies said, hey, wait a minute, like that's not traditionally how the internet's worked. It's not reasonable to expect us to pay these fees. And Comcast especially Comcast, I think also Verizon, responded by saying, well, we're just not going to upgrade the connections between our networks, which meant that as Netflix got more users and as the users used Netflix more, the quality of the service went down over time. And so it was basically a game of chicken, right? I mean, each side, each company, their customers were getting hurt. The customers were getting angry at the ISPs. And the question was, which side is going to blink first? And in January or February, Netflix blinked first and agreed to pay Comcast directly. Now, my reporting suggests that the amount that they paid was not a huge amount. It was comparable or maybe even less than what they had been paying the transit provider. But it set this precedent that that the Comcast is now entitled to charge money to deliver content to their own customers rather than paying intermediaries or exchanging. And sometimes networks will just swap traffic for free. It's a sign that they now have the leverage to demand these kinds of fees. And you can imagine over time that they'll be able to jack those fees up. And the problem is that if you're Netflix and you're trying to deliver content to Comcast customers, there's no way you can do that going around Comcast. The only way you can do it is if you have a deal with Comcast or with a company that in turn has a deal with Comcast. And so Comcast has a lot more leverage in this market than in the transit market, where there's lots of different companies that will take traffic from you to Comcast.
Right. So
I don't know if that was clear.
I think that was a good explanation. The main question that gets raised for me is, let's assume that Comcast is not just doing this for, you know, pure profit. Let's say that they're looking down the road long term. Why would they be trying to establish the precedent that they should be getting paid by the companies for this traffic? And my question, I suppose, that gets raised is you look at the evolution of how basically we receive entertainment content in our homes, right? Cable television has been going down, you know, the phenomenon of cord cutting, and then internet video has just absolutely exploded in like the last 4 years. Could this be a case where Comcast and probably some of the other last mile ISPs look at the future and they say the cost of providing internet to people or at least the kinds of internet traffic that consumers want, is going to go up a lot in the next 10 years because everyone is going to be switching to high quality internet video and possibly other services along these lines, more gaming maybe, I don't know.
Right.
And to them they say, well, there's two ways we can do this. We can try and get more money out of our consumers, or we can try and get more money out of the content companies. And the most, I guess, PR-friendly way is to go to the content companies rather than to the consumers. Because right now, you know, I went on Comcast.com, and you see that it's cheaper to get internet from Comcast than cable television. And maybe we see that change in the next 10 years, but maybe it's just a case that the price of consuming internet content from from anyone really, is going to go up because of the type of content that we're consuming via the internet.
Right. So I, one of the things I think is important to point out here is that the, if you look at the cost of internet, of long distance internet traffic, they've gone down by a factor of 1,000 over the last 15 years or so. So this is a very, very competitive market, and just from technological improvement, I think that's likely to continue. So it's certainly true that the volume of traffic that Comcast is handling is likely to go up over time. But I don't see any evidence to think that their costs are going to go up significantly. If anything, I would expect the overall cost of the service they're providing, or at least the cost of getting the traffic from the rest of the world to the kind of local network where they then have to deliver it to customers, is going to go down because networks are just getting so fast. There's so much bandwidth available. So I think that they, I would assume they're worried about having a future where people subscribe to Netflix rather than subscribing to cable television. But the thing is, like, if they establish the precedent that they get to charge everybody, you know, charge both ends of the network, then in a sense, it doesn't matter that much if Netflix disrupts their television business, because they can just charge Netflix, you know, whatever value they think the consumers put place on this content. They can either charge the consumers directly, or they can charge Netflix or some combination. And so the ability to that could undermine Netflix's ability to disrupt this market, because if you have to pay a toll to the company you're trying to disrupt, that doesn't really work.
Okay, so I think that makes sense, that maybe I guess the pace of technological innovation is going to be such that delivering more and more high quality, high bandwidth traffic to consumers probably doesn't raise their costs all that much. I wonder, so what you wrote about it, well, is the kind of consolidation of some last mile telecoms companies, specifically the potential of Comcast and Time Warner to merge. What are the fears that you see there in kind of the monopoly power that they'll be able to exert over some of the other packet and content companies?
Well, so I think it'll just make all of these problems worse. So I think we're kind of at a tipping point here where part of the reason you're continuing to see quality problems with some of these to back up. So you have all these transit companies, the companies that do the long distance internet service, and these big broadband providers, and the links between them are very congested right now because both sides think the other should bear more of the costs of upgrading those links. Part of the reason that's happening is that there's this kind of balance right now where it's kind of not clear. You know, it seems like Comcast has the upper hand, but it's not super clear. If you add another 5 or 10 or 15% market share to Comcast, they're going to have even more leverage, and so they're going to be able to go out to even more intermediaries and say, "You need to start paying us, start making these kinds of demands." And I think that the reason that's a problem is if you look at the history of telecommunications, anytime you have a monopoly where you have one company that has a unilateral ability to demand money from everybody else on the network, it's very hard for governments to resist regulating that. I mean, you know, they basically have to step in and regulate it because you don't want, you don't want companies taking advantage of consumers. And so I think we should all be very concerned about finding ways to preserve the market structure that had existed for the previous 20 years, where because you had a competitive market that was kind of setting prices, You didn't have to worry about government intervention. And so I think it's the market is kind of on the edge of being broken right now. And if these companies get even more concentrated, it's going to be an even bigger mess. That eventually, I think that regulators are going to have to do something about this. And anything they have to do is going to be harder to do if you have an even bigger and more concentrated company. I think the right analogy here is the old AT&T monopoly. So in the 60s and 70s, the FCC tried a number of policies to try to get AT&T to behave itself. They had a number of regulations about what they could do and couldn't do in the computer market. They had regulations requiring AT&T to allow third-party devices like modems on their network. And eventually what they realized was that there's just so many ways that AT&T can screw up potential competitors and you know, misbehave, that it's just very hard for a regulator to control the behavior of a company. And so what they needed to do was break up the company. Because once you have a bunch of small companies, it's much easier to kind of keep a watchful eye on them and make sure they're not misbehaving than one big company. And so I think that it will just be all the policy dilemmas we'll have over the next decade are going to be worse if there's one big cable monopoly rather than two kind of medium-sized ones.
So one of the questions I think I've seen written a lot about is the role that both mobile and mobile competition play into this, right? Is mm-hmm. that at what point would people cut the cord entirely? And at what point are mobile networks good enough that you can live on pure mobile data and not have, wireline internet service? Because that the wireline monopoly, but at, like I said, at the wireline level, I have Comcast that services me. I have a ton of different mobile carriers that can service me that are a little more competitive. You know, you could call it an oligopoly. I don't know what the market share of the combination of AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint is, but mm-hmm. those are the big four, right? But right. at least they're kind of competing pretty intensely for my business. Whereas at the wireline level, there's, again, just one company. Mm-hmm. Is there a point at which is there a technological point at which we might be happy cutting the cord entirely from wireline services? I mean, people are perfectly happy, it seems, watching YouTube videos online and on their TVs and whatever. And those can be incredibly low quality, but they're still providing enough entertainment, at least for a lot of different people.
Right. So this is, again, something. So first of all, like, obviously, we don't know. Technology and markets have ways of surprising us. And so, it might be anything I say would be speculation. But a couple of things to say about that. One is that this is something people have been predicting for a long time. I mean, again, if you go back to 2004, you had the same kind of conversation, like, yes, there's not enough competition in wireline, but wireless is about to come and you're about to have faster networks. And to some extent that happened, right? I mean, obviously today's LTE networks are way, way faster than the networks you had in 2004. I mean, there barely were data networks at all back then in wireless. However, I think there's a fundamental issue of physics, which is that if you look at the coaxial cable that brings your Comcast data to you, the basic idea of that is you have that cable where you have the entire electromagnetic spectrum available for just you and a few of your neighbors to get content. Whereas over the air, you're sharing, you're not only sharing capacity with a lot of other users, there's a limited amount of spectrum, you're not only sharing it with a bunch of your neighbors, but you're also sharing it with television and radio and military applications and astronomy, and there's all these other things that people are doing with that spectrum. Right. So I think it's always going to be the case that a strand of glass or a coaxial cable is going to have more bandwidth than a wireless connection. And you see that in practice in the data caps that these wireless companies have. So it's absolutely true. You can, if money is no object, you could hook up your TV to your cell phone and get kind of mediocre but passable data. But the problem is you'd blow through your bandwidth caps in a matter of probably minutes or hours. Right now, I don't think there's any cellular companies that will sell you a large enough data plan that you can, that it's a reasonable alternative for a service like Comcast, if what you want to do is stream a lot of video over Netflix or Amazon or something like that. Now you could imagine a world where bandwidth gets so plentiful that even though your Comcast connection has 10 times the bandwidth of your wireless connection, the wireless connection is still fast enough that you can do everything and everything works out. And I'm absolutely not saying that won't happen. But I think for the foreseeable future, people will kind of push the boundaries of the amount of bandwidth available. And so it's always going to be the case, not always, but for the foreseeable future, it's going to be the case that the companies that have wires in the ground are going to have more bandwidth to sell you than the companies that have to share all that spectrum over the air.
Okay. So the last thing I wanted to get to is in, I believe it was 2008, you wrote a paper that I thought was fantastic for the Cato Institute on net neutrality and kind of the principles going forward. And basically, correct mm-hmm. me if I'm wrong here, you laid out that the principles of net neutrality are worthy public policy goal, mm-hmm. but the best way, but government regulation was not going to be the best way to, I mean, both preserve net neutrality and allow for the innovation necessary going forward. And you've right. kind of evolved from that point. Do you want to tell me how you've evolved from that position and what made you change your mind that you do think we need stricter rules from the FCC on net neutrality?
Sure. So actually, I think most of what you just said, I still agree with. I'm not convinced that net neutrality rules are the really key thing that we need to deal with these issues. So there are a couple, the key thing that I think really changed my mind is we were talking a few minutes ago about that game of chicken that Netflix was playing with Comcast. And you actually, I think it's in the mid, like page 25 or so in my Cato study, I actually walked through a hypothetical example. It wasn't exactly the situation that happened between Comcast and Netflix, but basically I said, let's suppose that you get down to a kind of confrontation where a big company like a big ISP tries to get money out of a big content provider. And my prediction was that a combination of bad PR and kind of game theoretic considerations in the structure of the market would make it impossible for the ISP to win that showdown, right? And that was an empirical prediction. I said, you know, if this were to ever to happen, this is how it would turn out. And then the world sort of ran the thing I have been predicting about, and the result came out the opposite of the way that it had predicted. And this actually first happened in 2010. There was a dispute also involving Netflix between Level 3 was the transit provider then, and Comcast was the other party. And it was the content side that blinked in that confrontation. And so that made me think that that I underestimated the amount of market power that these last mile providers had, and that I needed to think more carefully. Now, I think that many of the things I wrote in the paper is still true. I mean, I made the point that there's a lot of, you know, danger of unintended consequences, and and also that it's actually somewhat difficult to define what net neutrality means in a way that will actually accomplish the goal of protecting an open internet with low barriers to entry. And I think that's still mostly true. I mean, I think that's especially true now that you have the interconnection issues in addition to traditional net neutrality issues, because it's pretty easy to write a rule that says, if you've got all this data coming in over one big pipe, you have to treat all those packets equally. But if you've got a company that has 20 different pipes, you know, that are connected in 20 different cities, and you know, they have different deals with each of those providers, it's much harder to write a rule that accomplishes what you really want to accomplish, which is to try to have some kind of level playing field among those. And so I think actually the FCC is in a really tough spot here. I think that some of the advocates of net neutrality or of other kinds of regulation take a little bit too much of an optimistic view and think that if the FCC just kind of gets tough, that we can protect the open internet. I think probably the FCC is going to have to do some things, but I think it's far from obvious what those things are, and I think that it's going to take a lot of trial and error and a lot of hard thinking to come up with the right approach.
Right. I mean, I've seen the proposal put forward, I guess, again and again, that reclassification of broadband services is kind of the hammer that the FCC can use here. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the FCC is super, super hesitant to do that. I think for a couple reasons. One, because legislators on Capitol Hill actually do seem to have a coherent idea of what that would mean for the FCC's power. Mm-hmm. And they seem very against it, and the FCC needs to be a little more subtle if they do want to kind of preserve some of the principles of net neutrality. But also that's kind of used as kind of this will solve all the problems. We can just reclassify and then do whatever we want. And that might not necessarily be either the easiest or the best way to accomplish what net neutrality advocates are pushing for.
Right. So to be clear, the Telecommunication Act that Congress passed in 1996 had two categories of services. You had one category that was kind of a low regulation category and one that was a high regulation category. And the FCC, the reason FCC lost that court case this year is that they put broadband service in the low regulation category.
Right.
I think the key thing to remember about reclassification is that it's not really a policy, right? I mean, the reclassification is a legal is a change of legal category that then gives the FCC some new powers, but it doesn't answer the question of what should the FCC do with those powers. You know, what should the actual right. regulations that they write look like? And I think there's a lot of people, and so I mean, you know, look, if you're a strong supporter of net neutrality, you really want regulations. Reclassification might be a precondition to anything that you otherwise would want the FCC to do. So I think it's not crazy for people on the left to be focusing on that as a goal, but it's not a sufficient condition to accomplish the policy goal of protecting the open internet. You would have to reclassify and then do some other stuff. And I think there's actually a number of different other things they could do. And I think it's not obvious which of those is going to be the most effective.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like you said, they lost the court case because they're in that lower tier of regulation, and presumably, you know, the FCC would be able to win those cases if they did reclassify.
That's right.
So yeah. And what did seem interesting is that the fast lane proposal is kind of a response to that court case, which seems to be a precedent that, you know, just like the Comcast Netflix payment agreement is, like you said, less of being about now rather than setting a precedent. The Fastlane proposal seems to more be setting a precedent that those kinds of deals would be legal under the current regulatory regime.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although it's actually not clear. So people, I think people who on the left who want to denigrate it, describe it as a fast lane proposal. That's not how the chairman has characterized it. The way he characterized it is that the legal standard here is commercially reasonable discrimination. And I think the way that he is selling this to people on the left is that basically the FCC will interpret commercially reasonable in as strict a manner as possible. And so they'll get something close to a net neutrality rule, or there might be a certain amount of fast lanes, but it would be fairly open and transparent, and I'm not actually sure exactly what it means. But But I think that the goal, part of the goal, is that because nobody's sure what commercially reasonable means, it's possible that if you had a net neutrality friendly FCC, that in practice they could do many of the same things they would have done under the previous net neutrality rule, and maybe it would take the courts a few years to reach the conclusion that actually you kind of snuck a net neutrality rule in the back door.
Right.
I actually think in some ways that's a terrible outcome, right? Because it means that nobody has any certainty. You know, startups have no certainty about whether they'll be able to, you know, get access to the bandwidth they need, and also, you know, broadband companies have no certainty about what kind of regulatory regime they'll have. So I think that's kind of suboptimal for everybody. But if you are determined to have net neutrality and not willing to go the reclassification route, it probably is the best you're gonna get from shorter reclassification.
Right. All right. I think that's about all the time we have for today. Thanks a lot for joining me, Tim.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
And I would encourage everyone to go read those graphs that you were talking about earlier were very, very helpful in kind of explaining how a lot of this works. So I would encourage everyone to go read that.
All right, I appreciate that.
But yeah, thanks again, and I will see everyone next time on Blogging Heads.